they've been able to do so in a manner that is very controlled and contrived by systems and people who want to be able to direct that. And they know that energy is there and they want to direct it in a particular way, and in particular direct it away from them, or even capitalize on that kind of energy without it actually being directed towards them, i.e. through things like real revolutions and you know, and political movements and stuff like that.
Yeah, one thing that, as you were speaking, Hale, too, it is interesting the rift between the perceived and the actual experienced. Like, when you're talking about the perception of, yes, like, that's the majority of your population, the majority of what you're seeing is just aggression and rah, 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 and, like, yeah, letting that out. Mm-hmm. You talk to the athletes at the lower level are like, yeah, like, and then as you get higher and higher up, you realize these people are leaning more into that philosophy, mm-hmm. leaning more into that, like, purpose, leaning more into that artistry, yeah. Like, these people you meet on the streets, and they're very kind, they're very sweet. You train with them.
Yep.
Like, I always, the training piece is always something that I find very interesting, is because as you're training as a fighter, you are, it's a very intimate experience fighting with another person, mm-hmm. that you are training with. It's even a more intimate experience being in the ring with someone.
Yeah, totally.
But on a practice level, when you're fighting with someone, you are 100% taking care of that person and 100% trying to rip that person's head off, because that is how that person trains. That is how, mm-hmm. he gets better. But ultimately, you're also taking care of that person. Mm-hmm. And then, again, to take that even a step further, when you're in the ring with someone, there's a certain level of intimacy when you're trying to absolutely, it's death. When you're in there, your end goal is, mm-hmm. to absolutely destroy the person in front of you. And, mm-hmm. at the end of that, you walk out and you're like, if I see you 30 seconds after this fight, yeah. I'm going to shake your hand and say, hey, yeah. you did, yeah. a great job.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we want to jump into something else that also came to mind, and maybe we don't
mind.
One thing I find very interesting about sport as well and competition is I'm actively wanting my opponent to be the best that they can be. For me to be the best that I can be.
Mm-hmm.
So when I, like, as I was saying there, like, at the end of a fight, when I look at someone, I was like, oh, win or lose, you were such a good fighter that I had to become the best fighter I could possibly be. Mm-hmm. And I need you to be at your A game. I don't need you to walk in injured. Mm-hmm. And that, again, I think is where the gap or the rift between a prideful experience in sports and, like, bragging and showing off, and an internal experience of growth and maturity and movement, which is a lot of what sport really is. Like, when I get in, I have a fight coming up on the 28th. When I get in the ring, yes, I want to win, but more importantly, I want to be brave. I want to really face something with courage and find the courage within me to get into somewhere where someone is trying to inflict as much damage on me as possible and hurt me, and I stand up for myself. So there's an element of courage there that I'm chasing after, more so even than the glory, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, that makes complete sense. And I think that's, like, I think you're pointing out, at least the way I'm hearing it, like, there's this, it's like a deep divide between, like, because, like, I have nothing but respect for, like the athletes themselves, like someone like yourself, David, and exactly what you're saying there, where it's like, you know, you're an athlete. It is an art. Like, it's an art form, and you care about your own performance, but also the performance of the person that you are competing against, and wanting everyone to be at their top level and experience that and go through that. And I think that's like the artistic aspect of sport that is so important. And that, like, Camus and people were talking about, where it's like that relationship between the actual fighters is so important and personal and has so much potential for growth. And then I think on the other side, like, how what I'm saying is, then you have the people who aren't fighters, who aren't involved, and this is, like, especially at the higher levels, who then want to turn that into something that's more of a spectacle-oriented thing. Like, so going back to the example I was talking about earlier with Alex Honnold, I was talking with my partner about this as we were watching him climb Taipei 101. You know, Alex Honnold, the climber, the free soloist, who again, like free solo is like climbing without ropes, without harnesses. It's extremely dangerous. You really need to be like on the top of your game. And frankly, like it's funny. In the movie Free Solo, if people haven't watched, if our listeners haven't seen it, I suggest you do. It goes through the list of like famous free soloists and like basically all of them are dead. Because basically all of them died like performing the sport because it is so dangerous. Like those are people who are doing it for like the love of the game. But it was interesting watching this Netflix sponsored version of this, where it's like, okay, well now we're taking a sport that is extremely dangerous, that is really pushes people to the limits. And we're really turning it into like, you know, we've got like a board of people up there, like, you know, kind of like announcers and, you know, like point type people. And, you know, now we're cutting to so-and-so on the camera talking about here. And it's turning it into a piece of, basically a piece of media, which is itself completely separate from the actual sport activity that you as an athlete are participating in, right? And those are two separate things that I think sometimes it's almost like, I hate to say it, but it's almost like the artistic side of the sport is sort of being taken over by the spectacle, the corporatized media side of things, where it's been turned into something else. Because it's like, you know, watching this, I was kind of like the whole time, I was kind of thinking, like, I thought it was super interesting. I really enjoyed watching it. But I was also like, you know, like, this guy could slip and fall at any moment. And if he slips, if he makes one mistake, like, he dies. Like, that's, like, it's not like so many other Netflix shows or whatever where it's like, you know, you're out or you've lost your point or whatever. It's like, no, like this guy will literally, this guy is like at like 1,000 feet up in the air. Like he's literally going to die. Like that's it. And turning that into like a sort of, as you and I have talked about, Brandon, a term of a form of present media, was really kind of like interesting and almost kind of like unnerving to see how that's been kind of co-opted.
It's also, sorry not to jump in again, Brandon, but it's interesting how that process also reverses back into athletes, where athletes turn it back into a spectacle. And now, again, not to go back to fighting, but going back to fighting, like a fighter now has to add all this drama to the fight. Like Conor McGregor is notorious for that. Like he made fighting this whole like human drama and spectacle and show, and people started coming for the spectacle, the media, as you say, as opposed to the actual art form. And I think it's interesting how like that cycle, again, like the athlete now, the climber, Andy, right? Climber now is making it a spectacle as opposed to making it this act of art. Like as you were talking, inhale, like the one thing I remembered was if you go to Thailand, you watch Thai fighters, there's a bit of a dance they do, or there's a meditation they do beforehand that I find very beautiful, because that is just a fighter within himself and whatever system he has within him of morality or worship or belief that he is engaging with for himself. I think an act of rebellion to claim that back in an age and in a society where they're just trying to turn everything into this media spectacle, money grab.
It's
interesting. I'm really glad, David, that you brought up this sort of like the interior or the internal experience or the internal practice of actually doing this, because I think you put it really well, right? Fighting, again, let's bring it back to fighting. Fighting in particular has this kind of what I like to call like a constitutive tension, right? In the one hand, you're having to obviously engage in this aggressive, violent particular activity where if you don't put yourself 100% behind it, well, then, you know, you're not, what are you even doing here? But at the same time, you can't like eliminate them. Otherwise, they're gone and you don't have anyone to act that upon. There's a constitutive tension there. And as that tension goes away and as you like, that in particular, like content and present media has to scrub that sort of away in order to make that. Well, first of all, it has to do that because you can't present an experience like that, right? That's the only way of doing that is actually doing it. You know, no matter how much you read about it or how much we philosophize about it, that will never put me in the ring to experience that. I actually have to do it. This is like what feels profound about it is that there is almost something kind of profound about the fact that for this extreme climber, Alex, there is like a life and death situation there. And he's preceded by people who have died like this. And the very fact that he's alive to do it says something about his relationship to death, right? The existence of that media, the fact that Alex is there means if the media is going to be, you know, if you're going to stream this on Netflix, Alex can't die. Otherwise, there's no Alex to make the media, you know, to make the show for. So the constitutive tension, just by the fact of being documented, is erased, right? It's uncapturable in that sense. And it's just completely deflated, right? It's the, again, it's, you can only experience it in that moment. It's only something you can point to.
Yeah, and you could see actually, like when you were when watching that Netflix thing with Alex doing this climb, one of the hosts that they had talking was another climber, and you could see compared to like they had a couple other hosts. One was like a WWE guy. Another one was like was a lady who was some sort of regular sports host type person, and then they had this actual climber who knew Alex well. And you could tell that of the three of them, she was clearly the most uncomfortable and the most stressed out while watching this proceed because, you know, she knew that, like, the stakes of what's going on in that moment, as you said, like, it's the plot armor's there. Like, let's say we already know because it's on Netflix. Obviously, he doesn't fall. They're not going to show on Netflix, oh, Alex Honnold tried to climb and halfway through he fell and, you know, splattered into a million pieces. Oh, yeah, they're not going to show that on Netflix. But in the moment, she doesn't know that. And you can see how stressed out she is watching him do that because, you know, that plot armor isn't there yet because they're in the midst of filming it. And it really is almost revealing of what's like, what's actually going on versus what ends up getting presented to the public as a sport spectacle. You could really see that in her, like that seeping through.
I'm really captivated by this idea of such a big rift between the experience of sport as an athlete and the experience of sport as a culture witnessing it. Mm-hmm. And there is beauty in both, and both can be real, even though they're really far apart. Like on one side, again, talking about like mm-hmm. football or the Blue Jays or whatever, you're really seeing such a deep connection with the people watching. Like, you're a Blue Jays fan, you see another Blue Jays in a Blue Jays jersey, dunzo. You are. That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then flip that on the other side internally with the athlete who, really, an athlete is at the purest level is trying to be the best version of themselves for the love of what they do, for the artistic expression of what they do. And those truths are so far apart, but also so real. Maybe there's a bridge somewhere up top that I can't see, but it's really interesting to see both realities so true and so far apart.
If I can venture a sort of a bridge, maybe it's that in terms of the spectators, so we can think of it as parts versus wholes, right? When you have spectators, you necessarily have a plurality of things, right? Because when you're looking at something, there's always a viewer and a viewed, right? But when you're having an... So that's like on the one side, you have a plurality there. And it's kind of, in that regard, it's disintegrated. You know, the two Blues, you can only have two Blue Jays fans who are like finger gunning each other. You can't have one unless you're like in a mirror or something. On the other hand, the athlete embodies that experience and that tension between them within their own experience, right? They're the one who's actually experiencing that tension. And that's why I was talking. That's why I said it was really exciting that you brought up that sort of, you expressed so well that constitutive tension within training, right? The athlete actually has to take into their singular experience those two conflicting elements that constitute what makes the experience so tense, what makes it so that it could go one way or the other, right? And it's not, and I, this also goes back to like an idea I've had sometimes about how winning isn't necessary. Like, obviously, you want to, when you're in a sport, you want to win, but there is something kind of like not satisfying and almost like pathological about a person who just like, you know, beats someone who is like way out of their league, you know, like, there's nothing really to be proud of. You really only have to be proud of something when you are met with a challenge, right? And that's that experience of the tension. That's what everyone watching sees. We don't just see, you know, fists flying or balls getting catched or something like that. You actually like are witnessing a tension in that moment. And, you know, whatever we, you know, I don't know exactly what that is. Maybe we can venture that, but there is something enlivening about that. There's something that we seek out, and sport is one way that is sort of codified in the culture for expressing that.
Yeah, I really like that, what you're saying. Like, there's no fun watching a beatdown, even as a spectator. Like, what was the point in that? You actually want the back and forth, you want the challenge, you want the close wins, you want the team that was down that came back and won. And so maybe we see ourselves in those stories. We see hope in those stories.
Let's go back to the Jays game, right? Everyone's home watching the Jays because it could go either way, right? You don't know which one it could be. It could be the Dodgers. It could be the Jays. And we're all rooting for the Jays. It could go either way. No one knows. It's sort of like this moment of contingency. It's getting shaped up in this very moment. There is almost kind of this like particularity to time, the way that we experience time in these moments.
This reminds me of a very funny bit that I've experienced a lot in fighting with a lot of fighters who they'll walk into an experience and just be like, or like walk before a fight, be like, oh, I know I'm going to win this fight. And a lot of people be like, oh, like, do you think you're going to win this fight? Are you going to win this fight? And all these kind of this language that people use that I'm always met with, like, if I thought I was going to win this fight or knew I was going to win this fight, I just wouldn't fight. I would take the win and go home. I have a fight coming. I don't know if I'm going to win or not. All I know is I have an opportunity as a man, as a person, as a human being, as a fighter to go in and find something within me to show up. Maybe that guy is better. If he's better, he's going to win. No amount of willpower. Maybe willpower will get me a little bit further, and all I care about is the willpower getting me there. But it's just a funny concept. Like, no, I don't actually know. Am I going to win? I don't know. But am I going to go up and show what I'm made of? Yeah, that's sort of the goal for me. That's what I'm trying to prove.
So there's a really great book that I like called Wisdom and Metaphor by Jan Zwicky. At the very beginning of it, like the first page, she quotes the poet Charles Simic. Metaphor is a part of the not knowing aspect of art, and yet I'm firmly convinced that it is the supreme way of searching for truth. How can this be? So there's something constitutive about this fact that you don't know. Like, if you knew, you'd be like, I'm not going to bother, right? Like, I know I'd win. It almost doesn't matter either way whether you go through with it or not, because you know it's already set. But it's this not knowing aspect that makes it more than just like, you know, you're over there and I'm over here. It's what makes it an art. And again, I'm going back to this idea of like a constitutive tension, right? And I get this idea of the constitutive tension. We've talked about this in our pre-Socratic series, Hale, when we were discussing Heraclitus. This is Heraclitus. They do not apprehend how being at variance, it agrees with itself. Literally, how being brought apart, it is brought together with itself. There is a backstretched connection, as in the bow and the lyre. So the way that the bow has two parts, right? It's got the bow string and the bow staff. the bow string is holding the bow staff together, but the bow staff is pulling the string apart, right? And it's that tension that makes the bow, because now it's tense and it can shoot arrows. Something about what Heraclitus is saying about, he calls it the Logos, but the experience of this tension is the experience of being. When you're experiencing this tension, that's being. This is kind of like a very interesting intersection between the philosophy of sport and at least my own interest in philosophy, is this experience of constitutive tensions as being the experience of realities, right? Like, you experience something real when there is this tension. Reality is some kind of resistance. It resists your knowing. There's something real about a fight where you walk into it for the purpose of finding something out.
Well, the sport itself would be pointless if there was no tension, because if there was no tension, we would already know what the outcome would be. Like, there would, like, the whole purpose of the sport itself, the fact that there's this competition, that there's, whether it's a single individual trying to achieve one thing or two people going for a fight or teams going at each other for, you know, to try and see who's going to win. There's always that tension there to find out, like, who is going to kind of come out on top, who's going to kind of break that tension or be the central aspect of that tension. If David goes into a fight with someone who's like, you know, say me and David are in the ring for some reason, like, what's the point? That's no longer a sport. The sporting aspect of that has simply disappeared because David David would kick my butt, and that's just a fact. And so therefore the tension is gone, right? There's no more interest, there's no more effort, there's no more artistry going on, because there's no more tension being played out in between the two competitors or the activity that's being crossed. It's the same thing with, like, you know, we're talking about Alex Honnold climbing this thing. You know, if you know, the story was Alex, you know, we're making this series where Alex is climbing a 10-foot tree. Well, everybody already knows that Alex can climb a 10-foot tree, no problem. There's no risk involved. There's very little skill involved. That's what is the point of that, right? There has to be some level of tension. There has to be some level of unknown that then gets displayed, or as other philosophers that we've talked about before, you know, think about Heidegger. It's like, in the process of doing that, a revealing happens that is the essential part of the whole sort of thing existing in itself, right? That revealing.
Again, talking about the observing part of sport and feeling like you're a part of something, I find it very interesting that, as you were talking earlier, Harold, sorry, just about the feeling of a battle, a story of wins and losses, of success and failures, of trying, and like the hero's journey. Mm-hmm. I think sports give us, as a community and as a culture, an outlet to experience that and, quote unquote, be a part of it. Mm-hmm. In a way that very few other things do in a very maybe monotonous or scheduled ritualistic life. This is a break in that for you to really participate in a hero story where you win and lose. Cause I think we're really like, you guys can speak more to this, but we're really drawn to this idea of struggling and striving and success and failure. And we don't really have that in a very monotonous ritualistic life. So sports give us a chance to participate in that.
There's kind of two levels to it, right? One is that we've been talking about, you know, the experience of watching a particular sport and like a match or something. It has its own tension. I think what you're also saying too, David, is the rise of a particular athlete. So there's this sort of microscopic instance of the tensions, but then there are those tensions that make up this series of a life, right? And we get to kind of follow along and almost in a certain way kind of constitute it as well. Fame and glory, these are concepts of sports as well. But if you're going to have a narrative form, there has to be a listener who constitutes that, right? There have to be people who recall the events and relate them to each other and give them significance.
There has to be spectators. There has to be people who care and are on the outside, like being involved. And that's why like, sports without spectators become, they lose something. But there's that balance too that we've been talking about throughout the whole episode, where it's like, on the one hand, I think about like the old like Greek Olympic aspect, where like the spectator aspect of the ancient Greek Olympics was such an essential part of the whole process, right? Like they had to have the spectators because that's part of what made the whole Olympic Games what they were, right? And if you don't have the spectators, well, then you don't have, you don't really have the sport really in the same way anymore. But the tension too, especially in the modern world that we're finding, is where the spectators or the spectator apparatus or those controlling the spectators start to then dictate what the sport is and what kind of sports are going to become popular and how they're going to be popular. As you were like bringing up earlier, David, how then that leaches into the actual performers themselves, where they then start to buy in and start to pump up the whole spectator aspect as well in a way that didn't exist before, because that's kind of like how it's being situated now and how it's growing now. It's through this, like, it's got to be bigger and bigger and bigger and grow and more and more and more, and has to be this ever sort of increasing thing. In some ways, it feels like the actual sport itself gets left behind, and the personalities start to become more important than the actual, like, performances and performers. You're thinking about, like, Conor McGregor and people like that, right? Like, where it's like, people know more about Conor McGregor. Like, people know about, like, someone like myself who doesn't follow that kind of thing knows about Conor McGregor not because he's a fighter, but because of all basically the carnival-esque, like, stuff that he does. And that in itself is sort of like getting away from the sport being something kind of pure and artistic in and of itself.
This actually really strikes a chord with me on a personal level, because I think, and I'm going to actually come from the other side of the tale of me as personally David, I see those things, and I'm like, me as David, I think I want to preserve the purity of the sport and make the sport about just the sport and just the art form. But as you were speaking, there was almost something beautiful about the connection between the athlete as a performer and the audience as a spectator. And maybe, like, on one side, yeah, sure, we're talking about the Conor McGregors or whoever who completely stripped the purity of the sport. But maybe it's not about the purity of the sport. Like, maybe purity of the sport is on one end of the spectrum, pure spectacles on the other end of the spectrum. There's actually a happy medium as an athlete. Yes, you are purely into the sport, but you actually want to give them a good show. Like, which I just, as you were saying, I was like, oh, wait, like, the purity of the sport is important. The experience of the spectator is also really important. Mm-hmm. So there is a halfway point in the middle there that, as an athlete at least, I can be able to do both, which is really interesting.
There is that perfect tension point. It's about finding that. The artistry of the sport and the participation of the spectators making the sport something that, like, as a community, people care about, and not just like two performers that make the whole thing what it is. Tune in next week to the Canadian Philosophy Show.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
We're from the Kiwassa Preteen Spring Camp. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Campus Community Radio from Simon Fraser University on Burnaby Mountain.
Standing up against racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
Everyone should be treated equally, and the legal system should work for the people, not against them. Every day, our network of supporters, lawyers, and educators from across the country continue to fight against injustice and oppression, both in and outside of the courtroom and at all levels of government.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.